This is Radio Freethinker, episode 98.
Welcome to Radio Freethinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, and of course also heard on CFBX in Kamloops. My name is Ethan, your freethinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. You know, Ethan, this has been a bizarre week for me. I had my birthday on the weekend. Thank you, everyone who wished me happy birthday. But there's been some like earth-shattering events going on. I mean, first of all, Kathy and Regis is retiring.
Really?
Baby Doc, who was like a horrible dictator in Haiti, has returned. And I discovered this weekend that all my life I thought I was a Capricorn, and it turns out I'm a Sagittarius. Apparently, there's a bit of a newspaper article that's been floating around the internet from Minnesota. I haven't done much research because you know how much I believe in horoscopes, but there's been quite a bit of a kerfuffle about how they've got the astrology wrong, and apparently the stars, the way they're supposed to be, aren't the way they're supposed to be for all those people who are convinced that their horoscopes perfectly predicted them. Apparently, not only were you wrong, you were doubly wrong.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder if we'll see some retractions in the newspapers.
I don't know. And I wonder how many people are going to sue their astrologer for getting it wrong as well.
That's a good point. I wonder.
But getting things wrong, I guess there's been more people getting things wrong. And you were involved in something recently, at least something I saw you on TV about.
Well, you know, I occasionally find my way onto the idiot box, as they say. But, you know what happened? We got a call over at CFI from the CBC, who were interested in this whole homeopathy thing. And we were kind of thinking, you know, we wanted to make a statement. We wanted to maybe do an overdose. And when CBC Marketplace, the consumer protection show, heard about that, they were just excited as you can imagine. And they said, hey, can we film it? And we were like, okay. So we filmed this overdose, and we're like, well, we'll see what happens. You know how the media is, right? But it turns out CBC Marketplace did their homework. They did a fantastic job, and they didn't fall into the trap of trying to tell both sides of the story. They got the science right, they figured out what was what, and they did a fantastic job of just presenting it in a really great way.
Actually, I'm going to argue with you. I think they did try and present both sides. It's just one side has a bunch of evidence, a bunch of proof, a bunch of science. The other one was, so how does it work? I don't know. I just just seems to. I mean, I was stunned when I was watching the show. You know, you had, first of all, they had this mother who was subjecting her child to all sorts of risks because she really believed in, you know, the homeopathy. And then you had the market person in Vancouver for one of the big companies in France that makes and sells homeopathy. By the way, big homeopathy. We're not talking a couple of dollars here, this is a billion-dollar industry, oh, yeah, right? And again, you know, they sat there and said, well, they did a lot of things, but it was just like, we don't have any reasons to believe this. We just kind of do. So it was balanced. It's just, there was evidence and information on one, and I hope it works on the other.
They did try to manufacture a controversy out of it, which is really great. But speaking of controversy, Marketplace certainly has been embroiled in it. This episode was actually the highest rated episode of Marketplace's history, and it's generated some major attention. Various skeptics groups around the world have been discussing the episode, and I've been sort of following it on Twitter and Facebook, and it's getting rave reviews. But so have the homeopaths. They've been urging their supporters to spam Marketplace's comment section. They've accused CFI of being in the pocket of Big Pharma, and they've also suggested that we're a bunch of communists. I don't know how they square that circle, but there you go.
Sorry, yes, and they probably know about me, and we all know that, okay.
Yeah.
But again, I know, well, see, that's an ad hominem attack, right? I mean, a classic ad hominem, and I guess they think it has resonance in parts of the world.
Well, that too. I just think that they don't have an evidence to stand on. So they resort to, you can't trust these guys because obviously Big Pharma is paying them. What they don't seem to realize, though, is that Big Pharma, if anything, has a vested interest in them because of the markup that natural medicine often is under. The big pharmaceuticals have said, hey, well, we can do this too. We can market all natural medication and mark it up 15%.
Well, and that's been the one thing that, I mean, we've talked about before in the show about if you go to drugstores, you do see the big pharmacy companies coming out with homeopathic versions of their cold remedies and all that, which do not work, but they're money-making corporations. And they say, listen, if someone is going to be stupid enough to buy this, we'll take their money, right?
Absolutely. And, I mean, the media follow-up has been great. Over the course of last week, I appeared on a radio talk show in Victoria, and they had a homeopath on the air with me, so we could sort of bounce ideas back. I kind of felt bad for the guy. He invoked quantum energy. admitted there's nothing in homeopathy, but that's okay, because it somehow works anyway. And even the host of the show was kind of like, wait a second, what are you talking about? It felt sort of like a two-on-one. And one of our volunteers with CFI was on the radio show in Calgary discussing not only homeopathy, but also the Wi-Fi hysteria as well. And so, I mean, it's been getting a lot of press, a lot of attention, and I think it's fantastic. I think that we owe a really great debt to Marketplace for, you know, shining a bit of a light, especially some national attention on this issue.
International attention.
That's right.
I've been, like I say, the skeptic blogs from all around the world have been all a Twitter about this.
Yeah,
I imagine
Steve
Twitter
Novella,
has been as well.
Steve Novella blogged about it recently, so did Phil Plait, as did ORAC at Respectful Insolence. So great coverage. And to keep the bandwagon going, we're going to have the host of Marketplace, Erica Johnson, on the show as a guest next week. So if you have any questions you want us to ask her, email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com. And of course, if you haven't seen it yet, you can check it out online at www.cbc.ca/marketplace.
You know, and just to prove the point, see, if we really believed in homeopathy, we wouldn't have her on. Because the more diluted the message, the stronger it would get. But of course, we don't believe in that. So full steam ahead. Let's have her on. Let's keep going while we can, everyone.
Yeah,
if
absolutely.
You know any friends, let them know. Watch the show. Spread the word.
So what else is making news?
Well, you know, we're going to go from fake science of homeopathy to some real science. And this is an article I thought was interesting. And it had some points in it that I thought were reasonably good. So apparently there was a study done recently that said that people who are in private rooms have reduced infection rates. Apparently, a lot of people who are in, you know, intensive care units often acquire secondary infections while they're in there. In fact, one in three will pick up another infection while they're in there, which means, you know, there's longer hospital stays, it's more expensive to our healthcare system, and obviously the patients, you know, run the risks. Mm-hmm. But instead of sitting there and say, well, you know, this is anecdotal, or, you know, I've got a feeling about this, a researcher at McGill University, a Dana Teschik, looked at almost 20,000 cases over 5 years, both before and after there was a renovation done in an ICU hospital in Montreal. And she tested on three particular three bugs that are resistant to antibiotics. MRSA, VRE, and C. difficile. If you want to know what they are, there's a thing called Wikipedia and Google. Find them, but just know they're bugs and they're bad for you. And they said that people who were in private rooms were significantly less likely to pick up any disease. And they just didn't stop. They just say, oh, well, it's because they're in their own room. The study then went on to say, well, what exactly were the features? Was it they're in isolation or whatever? And they pointed out to some things that, one, you know, they have their own private bathroom, mm-hmm. which is a source of cross-contamination, that apparently people's behavior changes when they go from one room to another. If you're in one room, you'll just slip from one bed to the other without necessarily sanitizing your hands or whatever. But when you have to leave a room and go into a room, you're much more likely to do that extra sanitation. They also mentioned, too, that there are other things that are important, like people's privacy. It's easier to protect confidentiality, and there are other effects, whatever. And then they also covered the big thing, too, is the idea of cost. They said, well, you know, private rooms, sure, it'd be nice to have, but it's so expensive, right? But then part of the research dealt with the idea is that hospital rooms and hospitals last a long time, and the amount of money you actually save on getting people out quickly more than pays for the extra cost of building the private rooms in the first place. Hmm. I just like the idea that, you know, this was a study, so there was actually evidence. It was a large study. It was done over a long time, you know, and they just didn't jump to a conclusion, and there's more follow-ups to go about this. I just thought it was a nice counterpoint to the homeopathy people saying, I don't know, it just feels like it works.
Yeah. You know? Absolutely. Well, why don't we take a commercial break here on Radio Freethinker, and we'll be back after this.
This is Phil Plate of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.
Your Friends of CITR card will get you discounts on Main Street at Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear,
Woo Vintage,
The Kiss Store, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl,
Flaming Angels Boutique,
and The Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus, or visit us online at citr.ca.
And we're back on Radio Freethinker. If you notice in the background, we're playing a bit of music. We don't always play music in the background, but Don, why are we playing?
Well, this is Dire Straits, Money for Nothing. And for some people out there, you may or may not know that we are actually, I'm not sure if we're technically breaking the law yet or we're pre-breaking the law, because there's been a recent ruling that says that this song is illegal and it's offensive. And you'll find out more about that later on in the show.
Absolutely. But let's move on to our next important news item. There is a hospice planned for UBC.
Ethan, what's a hospice?
A hospice is a sort of end-of-life care facility where, well, to put it bluntly, you go to die. It's you know, when you're ill, you're old, you're perhaps nearing the end of your time, you go to this place, you relax, you have nice care, you get taken care of quite nicely. So anyway, we have one being built here on UBC, but it's drawing a lot of news attention. This hospice would be located near a bunch of high-end condos close to Thunderbird Stadium, and it would provide 15 beds for palliative care for those approaching the end of their life with chronic diseases. But you know what? There's a concern that this hospice is going to draw the spirit world too close to the living world. That's right. Opposition has arisen towards this hospice, with Chinese residents who consider it opposed to their culture to have the spirits of the living and the deceased or dying nearby. A quote here, "It's based on the assumption that the world, as we understand it, is a unified single place that's inhabited by both the living and the spirits of the deceased. And there's a deeply held concern that we need to keep the spirits of the deceased separate from the living." This was from Professor of Chinese Religions Paul Crow. So we have this hospice that's going to go up here at UBC near some very high-end condos, and people are perhaps concerned that we're going to be invading the spirit realm or something. Now, there's a few other quotes here that I think are important to put to light. This one came from a resident of the condo. Quote, "In the Chinese culture, we are against having dying people in our backyard. We cannot accept this. It's against our belief, against our culture. It is not culturally sensitive." Now, as skeptics, obviously, this is not a legitimate reason to oppose a facility that will clearly do good, and it's a good example of how spiritualism, just like religion, can be used to justify a position that is, well, silly. There's this misplaced notion that I think spiritualism is sort of the nicer, easygoing cousin of religion, but in reality, we have two systems that are not informed by reason or critical thinking. And there's obviously no credible evidence that ghosts or spirits or ghouls exist, let alone that they frequent hospitals or end-of-care or end-of-life care facilities like this one.
I think, too, that there are some misunderstandings. I mean, one, you know, sort of the idea of playing the race card is kind of makes my... You just go, wait a minute, maybe there's something more going on here than just what's on the surface. I mean, one of the things that have been brought up is that, well, this might reduce the property value. Mm-hmm. But even if you take it at face value, I mean, first of all, Chinese people die. Usually they die in the home, at least traditionally, because hospitals are a rather new thing. So the fact that people are dying nearby, I can't see how that would be. I could understand maybe if it was a graveyard, right? And maybe part of it, and again, from what I've been reading, is part of it is just a misunderstanding as to what a hospice is.
Sure.
You know, I mean, a hospice is, again, it's designed to be a nice, quiet place where you're sort of taken care of during your last moments, and then you're buried just like if you died anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And again, I mean, this strikes me as the idea of taking care of your elders, treating them with respect right up to the very end. I don't see how that really conflicts with what I understand as traditional Chinese values.
Right. And you're getting at the sort of second layer to this story. And as I was doing more research, I realized that I think the whole cultural aspect thing is a bit of a ruse, actually. One quote that caught my eye comes from... I'm sorry, I'm probably mispronouncing your name. Tong Chan, former CEO of the Vancouver-based immigrant services group Success. And he said that people are afraid that the entire Chinese community is being painted as an uncaring and afraid of a facility that would provide good service to the entire community. What Chan and others are saying is that this has nothing to do with Chinese spiritualism and is all about... the cultural tradition of NIMBYism, which is
NIMBYism?
Ancient tradition of not in my backyard, and that people are afraid that this hospice is going to lower the property values of this condo, where, for example, a two-bedroom condo sells for almost $1 million.
Now, I might point out, because we've already been accused of being communist, why do they have a $2 million condo on university property? I mean, isn't universities for students? Okay, we won't go there, but I just want you to know that of all the things that I think are offensive about this story, that was the one that raised my ire.
Well,
but
yeah.
From what I understand, though, that even that isn't actually valid because, again, in the research that I was doing, it pointed out that there are hospices in Shaughnessy and Granville, and there's been no market decrease in the property values in those areas.
No, it's the whole not in my backyard thing is completely flawed. I mean, that's, and again, this, of course, this is not at all limited to Chinese people. I mean, when the first safe injection sites popped, people were like, oh, well, you can't have this in my backyard because you'll have drug addicts and blah, blah, blah. No, come on now. You know, all the evidence indicates that, in fact, having these things in your neighborhood does not cause an increase of crime. It won't cause your property values to plummet. It's not going to affect your life all that much at all. And to the credit of a lot of people, they're saying, look, this is... People here are trying to trying to make a point by using, you know, a cultural way, because they don't want to sound like jerks, by saying, I don't want a hospice in my backyard, right? And to quote Chan some more, he's quoted as saying, I'm not sympathetic to their plight at all. This group of people may be very, very nice people, good people at their heart, but they are trying to use the cultural argument to further their cause, nothing more and nothing less than that. And I mean, if you, according to some interviews that were done on campus with students and residents, they all agree that this is about property values. So there's nothing to this on the spiritual angle, which I think I agree with. I don't think there really is much to that argument. I mean, the point is what you mentioned, property values and location. Why, in the first place, are condos going up at UBC that cost $1 million? In the first place, that's probably a debate for another show.
Well, it also goes into the other thing that we have to be careful, because, I mean, there are some issues that I think are culturally sensitive, and we live in a multicultural society, and we have to be at least open to the idea that some people may find things offensive. But just because some people may find it offensive, that is not sufficient reason in and of itself to say, no, we can't do this. I mean, we've been talking before about blasphemy laws and how, you know, anyone can find anything offensive. And it's very hard to parse the people who are just using it as a tool, like perhaps in this case, or for those people who are genuinely offensive. But you need to have a sort of second step back and be able to look at things objectively to say, well, is this a valid form of offense, or is this just, we live in a society where people live differently and we need to accept differences.
Well, speaking of living differently, are there other cultures that live differently than us, Don?
Well, you know, I have two stories here that are kind of related, and I'm not sure whether I should give the good one or the bad one first. I guess I'm going to give the good one first. Well, I guess good for them. In Romania, apparently you are now, it's legal to be a witch. Witchcraft itself is seen as a profession, along with astrology and a few others, which are a bit more embalmers, valets, driving instructors. Now, apparently Romania has changed its laws to recognize witchcraft and astrology on that as professions because they were worried about cracking down on tax evasion. So I guess in Romania, there are a lot of people making a lot of money by being a witch, and they wanted to close that tax loophole. But in doing so, instead of saying, no, this is a scam, you're an artist or something and you have to qualify, they said, no, witchcraft is actually a profession. But of course, it's going to bite them back, because apparently at least one of the quote-unquote self-described witches has threatened retaliation. This is whipping up, quote, a brew to get back at them. So I thought that was hilarious. But of course, that being said, Dubai, which we don't always think of as the most enlightened areas, although I don't see why. I mean, anyhow, they apparently are jailing a wizard.
Really?
Yes.
In a tower?
Well, in a regular, boring, old prison. Apparently, a court has given a wizard, an African wizard who's working there, a 3-year jail sentence because he claimed that he could make millions of dollars rain from the sky. They apparently caught him in the middle of a ceremony where he was asking for a, quote, tip of about $55 that was going to be given to genies who would then proceed to shower down $25 million. Now, there's so much wrong with the story in itself, but I'm so glad that they had said, listen, this is nuts and you should be arrested for defrauding people. Although, who would be giving this guy $55 expecting $25 million back? I mean, really, if the genies were so hard up for the money?
It sounds like someone from the sort of Nigerian money scam where they say, I have like $80,000 in a bank, I need $10,000 to get it out or something. It's sort of like a revamp involving the supernatural.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. And then because the guy is African, so he could be a Nigerian.
Yeah.
He could be a Nigerian wizard, and that would make sense. But speaking of raining money, and last of my little short items before we get into something a bit more meatier, throwing money away, well, maybe not for a good cause. I must admit, if I had the opportunity, I'd probably want to do this. But apparently, if you want to book a trip to the space station, you can now do it. In 2013, the Space Adventures Limited are planning to sell 3 seats to the International Space Station. The Federal Space Agency of Russia is selling 3 10-day round trips to the space agency. Now, no one said exactly how much they're going to cost, but based on the last person who went up there, the founder of the Cirque du Soleil, Guy La Liberté, that doesn't sound like a real name, by the way, but he visited, and it cost him $35 million for his seat. So it's not a cheap seat, and maybe once he's up there, if he falls to the sky, that might be equivalent to raining down 35. I mean, if he's worth that much, but no, it's interesting. I mean, there's a lot of controversy about the commercialization of space, and like, most people may or may not be aware, but I believe the space agency is slated to be retired in 2015. There's debate about whether it will actually, but it seems so silly that it's almost complete, and then we're going to shut it down. Yeah. Maybe this will help inject a little bit of life into it. I don't know. I just thought it was interesting. Yeah. So anyone who wants to sponsor a field trip for the Radio Free Thinker crew to go up there and do a live show from the space agency, we will gladly take your donations and apply them to our ticket purchase of doing a live show in space in 2013.
Everybody has like 100 mil laying around. We'd really appreciate that. Well, why don't we take a break, go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker. When we come back, we're going to dive into the whole issue of censorship, and we'll be joined by our good pal, Daniel. So stay tuned for that.
Beautiful country. You know, I rode out here about 50 years ago on a little dun horse and started a film career. Picture called The Big Trail. Well, I made quite a few since then. Some good, some bad. Matter of fact, in those days...
CITR!
Matter of fact, they come in pretty handy anytime. Kind of nice to know you have something set aside. So if you ever figure on that, remember that
CITR
can be mighty helpful.
Yeah! The state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now, hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
Uh-huh. You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers are trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Bread and Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
And welcome back to Radio Free Thinker. Joining us now from his busy studies, we have Daniel back with us.
Oh, yes, I'm back for what? One segment.
Don't take this the wrong way, but it sounds like you've swallowed a frog. Are you still with the living, or are you slowly decaying to some sort of lich?
I'm beginning to think I am decaying, yes. My voice is not getting any better.
It's all that smoking.
I can use, like, the software to make you sound better. Well, a little better. Not great, but, you know.
I don't think software can fix... too much.
Well, we'll see.
See how it goes. What software? This is live. You can't fix things with software.
No, I can fiddle with the burly things.
Have you heard of live auto-tuning?
I could be singing right now.
You know, auto-tuning is an offensive word to me. I don't know. It seems somehow prejudicial or something that you're abusing people's voices.
Sure. Well, barring that bizarre statement, let's talk about censorship. And there's been some interesting bits of news recently that have drawn, I think, some skeptical attention. The first is the 2011 edition of a book called Huckleberry Finn. It was written by a fellow named Mark Twain a number of years ago. And it's got a few offensive words in it that have been censored or some would say just changed, the most famous being the N-word, which I'm sure most people know what I'm talking about when I say the N-word, has been changed to the word slave. And a term referred to Native Americans has been also changed as well. Now, the update was led by Mark Twain scholar Alan Gribben, who said the change was made to express Twain's ideas in the 21st century. He said he hoped the edition would be more friendly for use in the classroom rather than have the work banned outright due to its language.
I don't know. One of the things I find interesting is he says, you know, to bring up Mark Twain's ideas of the 20th century. But, I mean, one of the whole points that Mark Twain was trying to do by using that word was to point out the racism, the inhumanity. If I remember correctly, and I'm going to be paraphrasing this, at one point, I think it's Huck Finn or Tom Sawyer, one of them, goes up to his aunt, right? There's a boat accident, and she says, oh, what happened? What happened? Oh, well, there was a boat shipped, crashed, and, like, you know, 15 niggers died. And she went, oh, good, as long as no people got hurt. You know, and I mean, the whole idea of using the N-word, which I just used, in context, it's appropriate. So, but using the N-word was to point out how dehumanizing it was. I mean, the whole point of it, if you had just said slave, it would have, that's not a descriptive word. That's what John Stewart said, it was a job description.
Exactly. Plus, I mean, the books are going for historical accuracy, although, I mean, it wasn't really historical at the time. It was actually what was going on. But yeah. Nowadays, I mean, it sort of, it gives an insight into America at that time. And that's going to disappear if they change the language to such a great extent.
Right. And the argument that they're making that we need to make these books classroom friendly, I guess there's two sides to this argument. One, most kids can turn on MTV and see worse things than the N-word in a book. And two, if they're that young, they need to be protected from the book. Maybe they're not ready for Mark Twain. You know, there's plenty of other non-offensive books out there for them to read. Harry Potter, for instance. Why do we need to take a work of literature that has such import and remove its core?
I would argue that, like, you're never really too young for it as long as you can read it. It shouldn't matter that people have this silly idea that, like, kids hearing this word is suddenly going to turn them to racist or something.
Well, we were talking about this before the show a little while ago about how you almost, maybe in the one sense, like, if you're teaching grade 3 or grade 4 class and little Johnny discovers that, man, forgive the racial stereotype here, that little Washington, there's a new word you can refer to him as. Hey, Washington, you stupid nigger, or something like that, right? That might be inappropriate if the teacher doesn't have enough time in their curriculum to explain the cultural context, that they brought the book out because it's about free-spirited children expressing their independence, right? Mm-hmm. And that maybe in a later grade, where there is a bit more time to go into the cultural nuances, that you could censor it. Uncensored, sorry.
Well, sure. And that's, I think, that runs a risk. But again, I don't see how that's a terrible difference from the fact that most kids have easy access to offensive language whenever they want, whether internet or TV. There really is nothing stopping them from going online and listening to the latest rap video and coming back, right? I mean,
well, and how much of it is a marketing scheme to say explicit lyrics on this DVD or whatever, right? And, I mean, you just mentioned Harry Potter. Well, I mean, a lot of people have argued that Muggle is an offensive word, that it refers to low-class people. It does. I'm not making this up. That if you're aristocrat and you're special, then you're. But if you're just the low-class, unimportant...
So people are arguing that that definition of the word existed before Harry Potter?
No, that she actually kind of invented a new derogatory term.
Oh, that's so, like, in her world, sort of the... those with magical properties are like the aristocracy.
Those who rule above us, who are somehow superior through natural talents. It's not, you know, this is just part of the natural order. And remember, this is also done in a British context where there is a huge classes system. But we're diverting from the idea. Is I guess I'm kind of agreeing even with what Ethan was saying, that there are lots and lots of offensive words out there. And that maybe part of the reason, part of what we should be doing is just addressing the why is it offensive. And I mean, that leads to another issue that maybe I'm jumping ahead about music.
And recently it's been all over the news about how the Dire Straits song, Money for Nothing, has been, what is it?
Censored, banned,
because it uses the F word. And no, I don't mean that F word. No, not that one either. No, I mean the one that refers to gay people. Can I use the G word?
I'm confused now. I think that word is still okay. So right, the Canadian Broadcast Standards Council has ruled that the unedited version of the song Money for Nothing by the Dire Straits was unacceptable, and it has been banned. Interesting enough, a number of radio stations have actually protested this by playing the song unedited repeatedly for an hour.
Props to them.
Yeah. This is interesting, though. Apparently, the whole ruling came about because a person complained to the radio station CHOZ-FM in St. John's. This complaint got followed up until eventually it required a ruling by the CBSE.
Isn't it a little ridiculous that one person in a country of 34 million can complain about hearing something on a radio station no one's forcing them to listen to?
True, although...
And then it gets banned?
Well, from what I understand, though, a number of queer groups are supporting this ban because, again, if taken out of context, you know, it can be seen as offensive.
Well, I mean, that's the big key, out of context. If you take anything from Huck Finn or this song out of context, but again, I mean, think about, for example, if me and Don are having lunch, and I'm telling him about a movie that I just saw, and then all of a sudden I say, "Hello, Don, how are you?" I mean, it's a nice sentiment, but it's completely out of context. It doesn't make any sense. Likewise, if I saw Don and I said, "Yogurt," I mean, it doesn't make any sense. It makes sense that it's a word and that I'm referring to something, but completely out of context, it's kind of a ludicrous statement, isn't it?
Whereas, conversely, if I sit there and say, you know, Ethan, your example, you're such a stupid ginger. People who don't know, Ethan's got red hair. So, you're such a stupid ginger, and you're all ginger are stupid. I mean, in that context, I'm meaning it to be offensive. I mean, it's derogatory, right? Whereas if I said, yo, ginger, you know, I mean, there was a whole big debate, I remember, in the 80s and the 90s, much more in the 90s, started by Chris Rock among them, about black people calling other black people the N-word. And then how white people are sitting there saying, well, he used it, and it was meant as a, you know, term of endearment. Can I use it? And it's like, no, yes, no. And that's the whole idea, too, is words in context have a very different meaning.
And it's sort of important to realize that in the different things that we've talked about that are getting banned or changed right now, it's these offensive words are used in sort of an ironic way to almost make people be self-reflective about... the meaning behind these words, the use of them in the past. Neither of them is, like, no one in their right mind is going to say Mark Twain is a racist. Like, he was probably one of the biggest authors to sort of implicitly fight racism in the U.S.
Well, many people consider that Mark Twain was not only that, he was a humanist and in many ways... took a lot of the ideals of skepticism and applied it to his trade. So, yeah, it's a very odd dichotomy here. You have a celebrated author whose works admittedly have done more to prevent racism, and now he's being censored in the name of racism.
Well, then maybe we should make this a bit more of a meta discussion. So we've kind of said, well, in Mark Twain's use of the N-word, is appropriate. But again, me driving down the street saying, hey, you stupid N, get out of the street, you waste of space, is wrong. Well, who makes that decision? Where do you draw the line? I mean, the two examples we just used seem pretty obvious. One's black, one's purple. but they seem to be quite dichotomous. Mm-hmm. But where do you, I mean, there's a big gray in the middle. And at some point, words do become offensive. They are intended to be hateful. But we need rules. I mean, we don't... Everything shouldn't be arbitrated on the moment by whoever happens to be handy, because people have different standards.
I'm not sure what you're, like, implying here. Obviously, there's sort of different things that'll lead to offense, but are you saying that, like, the... Well, some usages of these should actually be banned?
No. So let's use the Mark Twain as our example for the moment, and we'll pretend that it is the N-word is offensive. So we don't use We don't use nigger. We say negro. Well, no, some people think that's offensive. So then we'll say black and say, no, that's offensive. Then we say, well, how about African-American? No, well, how about Americans of African origin? And at some point, you kind of got to say, well, we got to print something. And by what standards do we apply? Because we have the Mark Twain book. We're going to have 1,000 other books that may use these words of varying cultural importance. So who makes that decision? How do we draw up that line?
The artist writing it or the artist singing it? If people don't like their word choice, then go ahead and don't listen or read it. But ultimately, Mark Twain didn't write these down to be racist. He wrote it down.
How do you know that? No. I mean.
Okay, you're right. I can't know that with 100% certainty, but based off of what we know about Mark Twain, it seems very unlikely that he was purposely just trying to be racist.
And see, there you're already bringing in some criteria. There's a lot of academic research. There's the other works that Mark Twain has done that leads light into this. So is that the standard you're saying we should be using?
I personally don't care if a actual ardent racist uses these words. I'm not going to read what they're writing, but I don't have a problem with it.
So you must not be aware that we have hate speech laws in this country and such that with some words are considered, whether you agree with it in law or not, they do exist.
Hate speech implies more to implied threat generally than simple use of words in like an artistic context. But yes, there is hate speech laws in Canada.
Not to put words in Daniel's mouth, even though he sounds like he kind of needs me to do that. You're basically advocating that there's sort of like a free market of ideas, and that ideas that are horribly racist and dumb are not going to get promoted, and ideas that are thoughtful, insightful will get promoted.
I wouldn't say that they never get promoted. That's clearly, like, there's plenty of historical counterfacts to that. But I still think you face more threat in having someone arbitrate what people can say than just sort of the free market of ideas, as you're saying.
Well, see, now you're making a standard libertarian fallacy about that if we don't have some form of regulation, that there is no regulation at all. Well, there is. I mean, we were talking a few minutes ago about how it's a marketing scheme to put explicit lyrics on DVDs, because marketers, corporations, who will ultimately then be the ones who make this decision for us, will determine what is appropriate and what isn't appropriate, and they're much more willing to manipulate social standards for their own quite biased purposes.
Yes, but government groups like the Motion Picture Association that does the ratings for movies is probably worse. Go see the movie, what's it called? Not Yet Rated or something, to just see how ridiculous and arbitrary it is and how they try and like force values on Americans.
I think that any attempt to, like, I'm generally against any type of censorship. I think it's ultimately a futile effort. I think, though, that there is such a thing as self-censorship, and I think this is sort of happens automatically when people are more educated and more aware of what they're saying. We don't go around using the N-word just because we know there's a cultural significance behind it. We understand why that would be deemed offensive to other people. It's the same reason why, even between friends, you might joke around with them, but you don't go out of your way to insult them. And it's the same driving force. You know what will offend them, and you don't want to offend them.
But you just said, who cares? That doesn't matter. If I want to sit there and I want to call you a ginger because you're a stupid goddamn ginger, you're just going to have to suck it up. And if I do it on the public airwave, my apologies to all those who happen to be red hair. If I do it on airwaves, you're saying, well, just tune to something else. Well, what if the other channels are doing the same thing? Or what if they love you guys and they hate me? Right? I mean, you're sitting there saying that just sucks to be you. If you're offended, go somewhere else.
Well,
I don't like this country, move.
I think that if someone is... But again, you can't infringe on someone's right to express themselves. If they're saying, for example, you know, this person is different, ergo, you know, you should kill them, that's crossing a line. But again, it's like, for example, if a sportscaster goes on there and says, listen, the Calgary Flames suck. I mean, should Calgary Flames fans phone in and be like, hey, this is outrageous in a Vancouver radio station. Stop talking about us.
And I think now we're getting back to the same point, guys. We're on the same page here, I think. Because remember, what made the N-word bad? It wasn't that it was derogatory, but it was inhumanizing. That these are not people, these are less than people. And because of that, it was a justification for treating them as animals and not as real people. And that, I don't think, is something that we should allow. I mean, I think you're right. I mean, if I say they suck, if I use words that offend people, there should be a really wide boundary for what I'm allowed to say. But if I start inciting hatred by using particular words, by dehumanizing people overtly and without a purpose, I don't know. I'm not comfortable with that. And although I'm glad you guys trust in my my intelligence and my moral ethical character to know when not to do it, there are a lot of people out there who don't. And
well, see, again, but we also run into the problem, though. I mean, even if you know the proper time to use a word, someone who hears you might not. And then whose offense takes precedent, yours or theirs, right? Like, I mean, you know, we can say, okay, well, I don't really understand how in rap that they use the N-word with impunity like that. I don't really want to call up some rapper and be like, hey, listen, stop, you know, speaking your mind. If they think that that's the way that they want to express themselves, they might have a cultural significance to it that I don't share or even consider all that valid. But ultimately, their choice is up to them, right?
Yes, although there is one, and I'd love for one of our listeners to pull on this. We do have a slightly biased view, because although I've been stretching to use ginger for you, and, you know, everyone has their own words, but, I mean, you know, if you're out there and you are of a minority that has been offended by particular words, what do you think about this? I mean, we're a bunch of white guys here talking about the N-word.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that, Don. Actually, we got a couple of emails, and I wanted to take a look at one that we got here. This one comes from Maxine. And so she writes, I've listened with great interest to the social conservatives' rewording of Mark Twain, as well as the refusal to play Dire Straits' classic Money for Nothing. Strangely, I have failed to hear the same outrage at the objectification of the female gender in our world. I am forced to voice my observation, although I am keenly aware of the situation on a daily basis, because of an article that appeared in the Vancouver Sun, written by Daphne Braham. And she links to this article, which we can have in our show notes. But basically, it comes down to talking about a rapper, Kanye West, who released a video and has been described as misogynistic, graphic, and simple. And they go on to question, how can this be considered art and or entertaining is quite the question. And he talks about, you know, how very offensive words to women are used in this rap video repeatedly, and quite offensive to most people, I would assume. So how do we deal with this notion that we have somewhat of a double standard here, where some words are off limits, some are not, and some are floating around out there?
I think it just basically comes down to what's culturally accepted at the time. So rap music that objectifies women is so common, it's very difficult to not hear it somewhere, even if you're trying not to, which sort of goes into your point. I find it funny, because I've always noticed this, and sometimes I'll point it out to female friends and like who listen to songs like this. I'm like, don't you realize this song is horribly objectifying women? Like, totally making horrible gender stereotypes. And they'll just be like, yeah, but it has a catchy beat. And I don't know what to say. I mean, I personally don't like it. It's generally not music I listen to, but it's so culturally okay at the moment that I can't really see it changing much.
Well, you know, and it's funny, and I'm sure this has nothing to do with politics, but there is an interesting parallel. I remember growing up in the 80s, and you had all the glam metal bands, and they had, you know, the scantily clad women fawning over the guys, right? And then, you know, now you have rap music, and you've got, you know, there's a lot of this objective or pseudo-violence towards women, and it was Reagan in the 80s, and it was Bush in the 2000s. I'm just putting that out there.
Okay, but actually, I do recall seeing a documentary on MTV or something about basically saying, is rap more violent or offensive? And they compared it to, like you said, like sort of punk rock that sort of sprung up in the 80s. And they're like, No, it's exactly the same. It's the same objectification, the same words are being used. They've just changed the context a little bit. And I think sort of getting back to what Daniel was saying, you know, and sort of dealing with the cultural aspect, that it is permissive, that it is considered all that offensive, then I think perhaps people who are offended need to make a better effort to say, listen, I think this is ridiculous. I think it's offensive. I think when you go beyond that, though, and start saying, okay, listen, I think it's offensive, ergo it has to be off the radio, I think that crosses a bit of a line. But if enough people say, listen, I don't want to hear it, then the radio stations are going to say, well, it's not really profitable for us to play this. It's not really, no one likes it. Maybe we'll play something else.
Well, you know, and I also noted that there was, because I read that email as well, and there was reference to, was it Michael Imus in the United States?
Who, you mean Don Imus.
Don Imus, thank you. Who got kicked off the air because he was talking about a black women's basketball team.
Yeah.
And he used a different N-word, and he used a derogatory word towards women, and he got kicked off the air, but he didn't get kicked off the air for being a sexist. He got kicked off the air for being a racist that happened to make a comment about black women. I mean, there was an interesting sort of level of offensiveness there, and I do think that part of that is a reflection of our cultural evolution, that, you know, we are largely, because of multiculturalism and that, much more willing to confront ideas of racism, but we are still a male-dominated society and much less willing to face things about women. I mean, you know, women's issues do tend to be put to the side, you know, because they are not as important. It's much more important that natives have equal rights than women have equal rights if they happen to be native. You know what I mean? There's sort of that race being put above gender.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even in skepticism, I mean, how much debate going on about sort of the marginalization of women in skepticism, for instance. I mean, I don't know about if the IMA situation is quite that clear cut, because I do recall there was quite a bit of criticism labeled at him for being a misogynist. I mean, obviously, a racist misogynist is probably worse than being just a misogynist. But so there was an interesting part of the email where it says, yet when it comes to violence to women, or even the denigration of women, it can easily be cast in the light of artistic freedom or cultural norm. Or even, compare this to the local story about a local artist who is trying to use art to show the plight of women by honestly depicting the brutal deaths of the vulnerable in our society who were so long overlooked, ignored by society in an exhibition highlighting the mass murder of women by Robert Picton.
So, yeah, the idea that, you know, it's sort of a cultural norm to have
music that's sexist, but not...
Exactly, whereas if we sit there and if we had a show about a woman in chains serving a man, right, that'd be, oh, well, isn't that sexy or isn't that, you know? But if we had a black person in chains serving a white person, totally, totally different outlook on that scene. And, I mean, but... Content-wise, they're identical, right?
I mean, but I think it gets back to the point of context is the most important aspect of this. I mean, you can have, like I said, in satire and Mark Twain, you can have scenes of racism, but they have a totally different meaning. And some rappers and some people will even make the claim that, listen, the context of using this word is like ironic or something, and it changes the whole dynamic of why they're using it. And in some cases, you look at like the comedy of Chris Rock or Dave Chappelle, there is, I think, a difference to their style of using it versus someone who's just trying to be like, look how, you know, crazy I am. I'm using all these radical words and everything like that.
So maybe what you're saying, because one of the things about this is that this art display has been canceled at the museum here, because it's seen as objectifying women in a violent state. So that, in a way, you guys are against that just as equally as you are against the other forms we've been talking about today.
Well, I would say so. I mean, to me, if you're going to ban it, I think the much more way to ban it would be that, you know, you're kind of turning someone suffering into art who are still around to, you know, have to deal with that. I think that's a bit insensitive.
Plus, I mean, once again, you sort of have to look at the point of it before you can really judge it too morally, in that it's sort of looking at, it's an artistic representation of problems women still face today. Its intent is not to objectify women, but more to show that it's still done by people with deadly consequence.
There's one other maybe nuance we can bring to this, and maybe more to controversy. So the artwork was done at a local museum, one of the government-run museums. What if the Dire Straits song was on CBC? So any other radio station can do it, but the CBC stations had banned it because it's a government-run, well, we'll say government-run radio station. It's a publicly funded museum. Would that be appropriate? So you haven't banned the things outright, but you are denying them public funding. Is that just as bad, or...?
As long as whatever the government is banning through that avenue, it doesn't sort of doesn't say they have a monopoly on it and then ban it through their own channels. But if it's something like CBC, there's tons of other radio stations that can play it. If it's something like a government-funded museum, there will be other private avenues to go through that. So I don't really see have a problem with that.
Yeah, I don't really either. It's more on, I think, the onus is on the CBC or whatever group to say, we're not going to play this, but to go beyond that to say that anyone else can't play it is a big step for me.
So we can kind of agree then that there is sort of a role for government in establishing what we consider to be appropriate standards, but just establishing those standards doesn't mean you get to dictate those standards. So again, government agencies, government support can go to things that we think are good cultural norms.
The way I see it is it's sort of like the difference between the government saying you can't smoke in our buildings and then you can't smoke in any building. And I see that sort of like that. I don't have a problem with the first one. I have a problem with the second one, though.
Okay, well, that was an interesting discussion. Thank you, Daniel, for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us on Radio Freethinker.
Thanks for having me again.
That's right.
Bye, Daniel. Get well soon.
I'm trying.
It'll be a hot time in the Old Chapel on Saturday night, January 29th. It's the first annual Barn Burner Benefit, Vancouver's greasy rock and roll, rhythm and blues, and country review. Please join me, Bobby the Badger Ferris, host of the Barn Burner, for a night of honky-tonk and rock and roll mischief. This show takes place at Vancouver's newest and most unique venue, Chapel Arts, in the downtown east side at 304 Dunleavy Avenue, just one block north of the Patricia Hotel. The Barn Burner Benefit features the stunning lineup of Shiloh Lindsay, Rodney DeCrew and his new Convictions, and Minto. It's three headliners for the price of one, and the majority of the proceeds will be going to the greatest radio station on the planet, CITR 101.9 FM, and the greatest new venue in Vancouver, the Chapel Arts Gallery. Put on your boots and show your support to ensure that local artists and venues can continue to thrive in our fair city. In addition to the great acts playing, the night will also include a clothing raffle from Lifetime Collective, greasy cuisine, spaghetti westerns in the Galleria, and I'll be spinning the greasiest tracks between bands and after the show. Again, that's Saturday night, January 29th, 2011, at the Chapel Arts Gallery at 304 Dunleavy Avenue. $12 at the door, with doors opening at 8 p.m. There's no dress code, but denim on denim is probably advisable. The first annual Barn Burner Benefit, brought to you by Chapel Arts and CITR 101.9 FM.
Due to violations of the CITCR's Code of Ethics, the remainder of Radio Freethinker will be brought to you by Sensorvision.
That's horrible.
Yeah, I know. What sounded better in my head?
Well, it's been a fantastic show. Our thanks to Daniel for taking time out of his schedule once again to join us. And why don't we move on to our skeptical highlights before we end the show out?
I have an interesting one that our political skeptic fans should have their eyes open. WikiLeaks is yet again in the news. Apparently a Swiss banker who has been described as a disgraced banker, but he's disgraced because he released this information and was fired from his job because he said, listen, this doesn't sound right to me. Anyhow, this former Swiss banker has several thousand Swiss bank documents that he's released to WikiLeaks that apparently shows a lot of illegal transactions, a lot of tax evasion, some legal tax manipulations and all that sort of thing. But WikiLeaks has these
files, and they're supposedly going to be releasing them soon. They, of course, being a semi-responsible organization, are redacting some of the names and making sure that they're authentic and valid and doing all that. They're not as bad as everyone has been laying out be. But keep your ears open and keep an eye on WikiLeaks, and there may be some new stuff that has nothing to do with the American government, with wars or anything, but with money, and we all love money.
Money is awesome. Well, a couple of skeptical highlights as well. On January 22nd is Cafe Inquiry, How to Pwn a Believer. And that's going to, of course, Saturday the 22nd, 11 a.m., SFU Harbor Center. And it's going to be all about how to argue with a believer, when to press the issue, when to walk away. It's going to be a very fascinating conversation, so please come out. On the 28th, we have a CFI lecture called Does God Hate Women? Presented by Ophelia Benson, who is a very fantastic writer. It's going to be in UBC, room A102, Buchanan Building, January 28th, 7 p.m., admission $5, general admission, $2 for students, and free for CFI members. So please come out and check out those fantastic events.
I'm sure some people who are listening to the part we just did about censorship and language and about how that reflects the difference between racialism and sexism, this might be a very interesting discussion to go to about does God hate women.
Absolutely. Well, we're pretty much out of time here on Radio Freethinker, so thanks for listening. My name is Ethan, your freethinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
So long, folks.